Today, we're going to tell you about whistleblowing in Africa. Not only are there brave whistleblowers calling out government and corporate malfeasance, but they're doing so at great personal risk. We'll speak with a whistleblower from South Africa who literally put his life on the line to report on police criminality. I'm John Kiriakou. You're watching The Whistleblowers. A suit has now been filed against American social media giant Meta and SAMA, its main contractor for content moderation in Africa. The companies are being sued over claims of exploitation, and a union-busting law firm representing Facebook whistleblower Daniel Motong, a former content moderator who was making $2.20 an hour. Originally from South Africa, he was working in Kenya, but then was allegedly laid off after he led more than 100 of his colleagues in a unionization effort for better pay and working conditions. He claims that Meta and SAMA are, quote, subjected to current and former content moderators to forced labor and human trafficking for labor, unquote. And he suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of his work. Now, in an application, the law firm said SAMA also carried out a deceptive recruitment process by opening up vacancies and failing to mention the nature of the job that successful applicants would do. The moderators at the Nairobi hub are sourced from a number of different countries, including Ethiopia, Uganda, and Somalia, and they work day and night, working as outsourced Facebook content moderators. They're basically the emergency response force for social media. They're in charge of viewing and removing illegal or banned content from Facebook before it's seen by the average user. We're now joined by Ari Danikas, a research fellow at Blueprint for Free Speech and a fellow whistleblower. Ari, we will get to your story in the second half of this show, but first, what's your take on the lawsuit that this man and his former colleagues are claiming are victims of forced labor, human trafficking, and union busting?
This is shocking, but you have to see the bigger picture in South Africa. You know, we have an uneven distribution of wealth, and you have nearly 50 million of Africans living in South Africa. You have a few millions of non-Africans. And however, you have, like I said, an even distribution of wealth. So 90% of that wealth goes towards whites and non-Africans. That's a recipe of disaster.
Now, in recent years, whistleblowers, politicians, and critics have accused Facebook of a slew of things, from facilitating drug and human trafficking, allowing extremist groups to coordinate online, fueling conspiracy theories and misinformation, and promoting even eating disorders. Now Facebook denies many of these allegations, or they say they're issues that are more complicated than they appear to be. Former Facebook executive Francis Hogan testified in front of a Senate subcommittee in October that Facebook is in fact damaging girls' body image, dividing the nation, and allowing extremists to thrive. Even worse, that the company knows they're doing this and they choose to largely ignore it. And so let's take a listen, actually, to this testimony from Frances Hogan.
I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. Yesterday, we saw Facebook get taken off the internet. I don't know why it went down, but I know that for more than 5 hours, Facebook wasn't used to deepen divides, destabilize democracies, and make young girls and women feel bad about their bodies.
Frances Hogan has led the most arguably threatening scandal in Facebook's history. And recently, the former Facebook executive and a whistleblower spoke to Daniel Motong and is calling for solidarity with non-unionized content moderators in Africa. The two met at an event in London that was organized by Motong's attorneys. But it's interesting here because we know now that the tale of two whistleblowers who are completely different but who are bound together by a common experience and a single company. Hogan was a top executive at one of the biggest social networking sites in the world, while Motong, on the other hand, was a part of the company's more invisible workforce, about 15,000 people, often in developing countries. Now they both have spoken out about their ordeal in the press quite a bit. But a lawyer representing Facebook's parent company, Meta, called on a judge to, quote, crack the whip, unquote, against the company, requesting a gag order to prevent Motong from speaking to the press. Ari, why do you think Facebook is trying to silence Motong in this case, but has let Hogan speak freely?
Well, that's a typical slap suit, isn't it? We've seen this all around the world. And we try to actually get the legislations in order to prevent such slap suits against whistleblowers. If they can't silence us by physically killing us, you know, they will try to intimidate us by any other means. That can be fake news, character assassination by fake news, or slap suits. It's a standard procedure that they follow.
So this is something that you've seen in your experience, but now I want to talk about the media and how it's praised the efficacy of its AI systems. In the past, Mark Zuckerberg has even told congressional hearings, at least in March of last year, that the company relies on AI to weed out about 95% of hate speech content and that it wants to get its AI technology to a human level of intelligence. But according to Hogan and Motong, this is just a smokescreen that obscures the work done by thousands of human moderators, some who even suffer from severe mental issues, they say, which come as a result of their work. What's your take on this?
I can tell you now that I keep my kids away from Facebook as much as I can. I suffered from Facebook's hate of speech when my identity was, you know, this was out. A couple of years ago, you know, as the whistleblower who blew the whistle on human rights violations of the African police force. And I was horrified to open the Facebook. You know, there was a systematic propaganda against me, and there was no control. I've tried to write to the, you know, officials on Facebook. I could not get any reply, and eventually I had to live with it. It's traumatic and creates more and more pressure to whistleblowers.
Absolutely. I can only imagine the type of pressure these whistleblowers are under, and it probably deters a lot of other potential whistleblowers from coming forward. Are there resources in Africa to help whistleblowers? Are there private organizations like your Blueprint for Free Speech that can help whistleblowers in Africa?
Well, John, recently we started a public awareness campaign over the last year or two in order to assist further in South Africa. Currently, there is a new legislation, already reform legislation towards the Whistleblower Protection Act and public disclosure. But I'll be honest with you, I truly believe that it's for the privileged and elite. I came to understand that certain NGOs in South Africa are picky and they're choosing only celebrity cases. Mm-hmm. That is tragic. And they left a lot of legit whistleblowers to dry. We have a recent story of the late Babita Deokaran, who got assassinated in front of her house, in front of her daughter, because she become a whistleblower and she blew the whistle on corruption in procurement of medical aid, emergency medical aid for COVID. It was terrible. There are many cases like that. And actually, there is a message we say as, you know, as Ari and as Blueprint before, you know, South Africa, stop killing your whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. There's just no support at the moment. We're trying our best to help them. But it's difficult.
It's difficult. It's a tall order. Thank you, Ari. But don't go away. Ari Dinikas will return after the break to discuss his own whistleblower story where he revealed the existence of death squads. That's right, death squads that were murdering people suspected of minor crimes in South Africa. When he did that, his own life and the lives of his family members were immediately put in danger. Stay tuned.
If you speak Russian, keep your voice down while out and about.
Иногда приходилось врать просто в силу страха какого-то.
Don't put your homeland symbols on display.
Если что русскоязычное, то отторгается и подвергается нападкам.
Don't talk to strangers.
Обиди сюда, Что? Чтобы подошли москали.
Avoid noisy gatherings and rallies.
Меня, по сути, назвали фашистом. И, в принципе, меня называют по сей день так называемым термином «рашист».
Even your colleagues and perhaps also your friends think you're guilty because you're Russian.
Они начинают говорить о том, что мы вас найдем, мы вас знаем всех в лицо, ходите, оглядывайтесь.
Но ответственность коллективная, да, вот детям достается. Были избиения детей, когда действительно ребенок попал в больницу, и об этом сообщили полиции, то есть это все вышло на официальный уровень.
We're back with the whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Under apartheid, South Africa's police were notorious for extrajudicial killings and for the routine use of torture against political dissidents. Only later did it emerge that these same techniques were being used well after the fall of apartheid, when the victims were only suspected of criminal behavior and minor criminal behavior at that. Ari Denikas began secretly documenting the atrocities he witnessed when he was an auxiliary policeman, and he was soon forced to flee South Africa for Greece, where he posted all the videos he recorded on YouTube. He blew the whistle on his own co-workers in the South African police, and they tried to label him a liar and a disgruntled employee. But for Ari Denikas and other whistleblowers, some things are either right or they're wrong. There's no gray area. And what he was witnessing, the police killing of men who had not even been formally accused of a crime, was just plain wrong. He decided to go public, knowing what the cost was going to be to himself and to his family. Now we're rejoined by our guest, Ari Denikas. He's a research fellow at Blueprint for Free Speech. Ari, tell us about your case. What did you do that made you blow the whistle?
Thank you, John. Well, in 2001, I was invited to join the reserve police force. Now, to me, that was a great opportunity since I come from a family of police officers. I mean, my brother was a police officer, my uncle, my cousin. So everybody was a police officer. Now, I was the geek of the family. I was thinking towards the computers. But in South Africa, that opportunity arose, and I joined the force. Now, in 2004, I witnessed the first torture of the unit, and it was horrific. It was terrible. I mean, I grew up in Greece up until 17 in a democratic country, and you know, that's not the way I've been brought up. Mm-hmm. So, when I saw an African suspect, he was just a suspect of a stolen laptop, being stripped naked, placed into a chair, and then police officers putting a bag over his head and suffocate him, you know, that was a turning point for me. So what I did at this point was, at the time, the smartphones, they just started coming out. So I took out my smartphone, and I pretend I was talking to my mother in Greece, in Greek. Now, you know, the guys knew that this Greek, you know, he always speak to his family overseas. So they didn't go suspicious. At the same time, as I was going, Ella Mana, which means hello, mom, I took three shots through video clips of the actual torture. Mm-hmm. Now, how they discover me at the time, I wouldn't be here talking to you. So after that, I did what I know now, it's a textbook internal disclosure. I went to my commanding officer, who was also a supposed close friend of mine. And I told him, look, those guys, you know, the criminals, they're doing gross violations of human rights. This is what they're doing. And I saw him the video clip. The man, you know, he just laughed and he said, that's my boys. That's how we make progress. Get rid of it. Of course, I didn't. That was the first time that I became a whistleblower. And that's what started my problems in South Africa.
You were talking about that pivotal moment when you saw police putting a bag over this person's head, and you made a decision right there to become a whistleblower. Did you take into consideration the long-term effects from this and how it might impact your life and the lives of your family members? And what would you say the most challenging aspect of this has been for you?
At the time, I had no idea what a whistleblower was. The terminology whistleblower did not exist in my vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Internal disclosure, public disclosure didn't exist in my vocabulary. I wasn't trained about it, and nobody had ever told me what to do. It was just a spontaneous movement. And that is the difference between whistleblowers and paid informers. A whistleblower is a citizen of consciousness. Okay, we follow our conscience. And at the time, I didn't know what the future would bring. I didn't know the repercussions, the danger I was in. I just acted. And obviously, I acted as I felt like it was the right thing to do. And that's what I did without knowing the danger that will follow later on.
Ari, in 2015, the Greek government asked me to help them write a new whistleblower protection law. And so I went to Greece 3 or 4 times that year. In one of those meetings, I was seeing the Minister of Justice. When we were speaking, I kept using the word whistleblower, and finally he stopped me and he said, "What exactly is this word you keep using, whistleblower?" And so I explained what it was, and he said, "Oh, you mean like a rat or a snitch?" And I said, "No, not at all like a rat or a snitch." We had a separate conversation about what to call a whistleblower in the Greek language. The word that we came up with translates to sentinel of the public trust. I think that best describes what a whistleblower is. Whether you intend to be a whistleblower or not is irrelevant. If you make a revelation that reports on waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety, you are a whistleblower. Now, what they don't tell you is what's going to happen to you psychologically after you make that revelation. We heard about Daniel Motong and the fact that he had PTSD, which he still suffers from. What did you go through after you made your revelation, and especially after you realized that you were going to have to leave South Africa with your family in order to save yourselves?
John, it was a nightmare. I suffered such a hard retaliation that, I mean, I end up living like a thief in the middle of the night with my wife. Literally, we were taken away from by a colleague, a South African Greek, actually smuggled us to Johannesburg from Durban with his car. He paid with his own credit card for the one-way ticket to Greece. And I can tell you, after I landed, I actually went down on my knees and I kissed the ground I was onto. But the problem for me started when I decided, while I was in Greece, to help the South African authorities prosecute those people responsible for human rights violations. And that's all how hell broke loose, because I am a living example of how not to handle whistleblowers. We suffer from PTSD. Both me and my wife have been attending, over the internet, with a South African doctor, some psychological consultations to try to be able to know how to breathe properly and how to control our fears. It's not an easy process, especially when you have young children and a family on the way. So it's hell. It really is hell. And especially when you left, unprotected, and you've been fooled by the authorities. You become the scapegoat due to political, interests. Mm-hmm. It's complicated, and eventually the whistleblower becomes the scapegoat. So it is a very complicated process to digest.
Absolutely true. Ari, I happened to meet with an American medical whistleblower, and she told me the PTSD was the most difficult and most unexpected part of her experience. She said that she has struggled with depression since she went public with her revelations, and nobody but other whistleblowers really understands why she's having a hard time. And in my experience, and I know in years as well, that's an ongoing theme among whistleblowers, feelings of depression and abandonment, a feeling of having to fight the whole world by yourself. What advice would you give to other people considering blowing the whistle to protect their mental health?
John, I have been asked this question before, and especially on motivation speeches when advocate for whistleblowers. My advice now, but I'm 51 years old and I've dealt with whistleblowing over 20 years, is know your rights, know your local laws, and make sure that you know what you're getting into. Mm-hmm. So do your homework first. Times have changed. We now have secure mechanisms, protection, secure mechanisms for whistleblowers to do anonymous tipping, of public disclosure. We have now in Europe a directive for the Protection of Whistleblowers Act of 2019. So we have mechanisms in place for exactly this problem. Mm-hmm. So the whistleblower doesn't go through that ordeal. And to me, discuss with your family. Make sure you have your family support. Make sure you know what you're going into and be prepared for everything. Make sure you have an escape plan. And also, I will say, it's difficult. It's difficult now because I get emotional through that process. Think of your family first.
It impacts everybody. It doesn't just impact the one person who's coming out and speaking their truth. And I would imagine that every circumstance is different. So overall, would you say the essence of whistleblower trauma is rejection and persecution? Do you think that the key to the recovery process involves empowerment and communal acceptance? Why? What do you think?
Well, let's separate the two. We have whistleblowers that their life is directly in danger. So there might be an assassination attempt against them. Now, those people, for the rest of their lives, will have to look behind the back, mm-hmm. okay? That is something that you cannot get over. You need constant therapy for it. And you have the other side where you suffer humiliation, you suffer a character assassination by fake news media, mm-hmm. you have been isolated by your community, your family, and also you have dropped down your standards of living. You've lost your job, you're unemployed, you have lost your income. So that's now a different subject altogether. They're two different things. So it depends on which category you fell into. There is a certain degree of stress and obviously post-traumatic stress disorder.
The biggest takeaway here is for whistleblowers or people considering coming forward with important information is to protect themselves. A.L. Press, an Israeli journalist, wrote a book a few years ago offering psychological profiles of four whistleblowers throughout history. The book is called Beautiful Souls. He found that all whistleblowers share several traits in common. Whistleblowers have an unusually well-defined sense of right and wrong, far more well-defined than the population at large. They tend to see the world in cases of black and white. They never regret blowing the whistle, even if the cost to them is very high. And sadly, they almost never make a financial comeback. Would you agree with this assessment? Has that been your experience?
John, absolutely. I mean, I was a prominent businessman in South Africa. Mm-hmm. I immigrated when I was 17. And because I was, you know, like I said, a gig in electronics and I was a hardworking immigrant Greek, mm-hmm. I worked hard, I created a business. By the age of 24, 25, I had my own business, my own house, my own car. And I was, you know, I had no family, no liabilities. And by 2008, because I decided to offer to my community and be a volunteer for the police force, my whole life just you know, crumbled under my feet. I've lost everything. I had to go on exile with virtually nothing. I had to start again in a country which was a strange country to me. I mean, I was away for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I grew up, I educated myself, and I became a man in South Africa. So South Africa was my country. And then I start to process you know, information of how to adapt in a new country, in a language that I almost forgot about it. Mm-hmm. And also, I became a parent. I had, you know, kids in the way. So it was extremely difficult. Because the years go by and because you change environment, a business environment so drastically, it is very unlikely you're going to recover financially. Maybe one in a million. I don't see us recover and say, right, we're now living as good as or better now than before before we blew the whistle.
Ari Dinikas, thank you so much for joining us. That's all we have for you today. We'll catch you next time. I'm John Kiriakou, and this has been The Whistleblowers.